This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. A very happy new year because we're beginning 2017 with a fresh podcast. And we pledge that we will bring you the best of health information in 2017. I'm today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, who capably helps me field questions that come from you. You can send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com, and we'll do our best to answer your questions in 2017. So, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. How are you doing?
Good. I hope you had a good New Year.
Yes. Okay. Quiet as usual, which is how we like it.
Right. In bed by 10:30?
In bed by 10:30. That's my bedtime.
Okay.
I like that.
You don't. you didn't do the Central Park run? That's one of the things that, you know, it's on my bucket list to do that in one
really?
Of these days. But it's too late.
It's too late.
It's not that it's too cold. It's not that it's too cold.
It'll be cold for me.
Well, because I don't mind running when it's about 40.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be totally intrepid. I would run in like any time it was at least double digits, I would run. You know, I remember running, one day when it was like 11 degrees. I'm getting a little bit, a little bit more towards my comfort zone as I get older. But it's about that, you know, late night thing. I don't know. Kind of destroys the next day.
Oh, sure. Because then you're up and you're amped and you're not going to sleep till 3. And
right.
What good is that?
Yeah.
The problem,
we're such party animals, Lola. We are such party animals.
The trouble is, I'm going to wake up at 6 no matter what.
Yeah.
If I go to bed at 4, I'm going to wake up at 6. It's going to take me a little time, maybe on a night like that, to go back to sleep. But then I'm all messed up.
You know,
I'm discombobulated.
What I noticed that is the night of the election, you know, I was riveted and I stayed up really late. Although, unlike some people, they stayed up the entire night watching it.
Yeah.
You know, I stayed up till like maybe 1:30 or 2. Then I went to sleep. Then I was pulled up right at like 6 o'clock. Of course, it was exciting to see like what was the ultimate outcome of the election.
Yeah.
But they kind of called it by the time I went to bed. But I noticed that, you know, I'm pretty locked into that kind of rhythm. Now I can, you know, make myself sleep to 7, 8. Not much longer than that. I get a little sleep drunk. I think if I sleep too much.
And I like that term because if you get too much sleep, you wake up and you're kind of groggy all day long.
Yeah, there is a happy medium.
Right.
But, you know, we're all about, circadian rhythm
and
regular diet. I mean, it's a little boring, actually, but.
But it feels great.
Exactly. It's worthwhile. It's worthwhile.
You know,
the payoff is that it's worthwhile.
When the bar of wellness is up to here, you don't want to go below that anymore because
exactly.
It just feels so good.
Yeah. I had very irregular lifestyle, very irregular hours when I was much younger. But much of the time, I think it contributed to some degree of exhaustion, mood swings, lack of productivity, depression sometimes because it was, it just bends you out of shape.
It does.
And that's advice to many patients is, I say, Mr. Roberts, Mr. Rogers, rather.
Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers.
It's a perfect day in the neighborhood. Yeah. You know, it's like that kind of even thing, you know.
Right.
And what's interesting, too, I know this is a big digression, but I've studied the Victorian era.
Mm-hmm.
And the Victorian era was very interesting because they were all about reducing excitation. That was sort of the ethos of the Victorian era, that they wanted you to not engage in activities that were excitatory because they felt that this was pernicious for the body and that everything was sort of routinized and made more bland. And, you know, and that's, I mean, obviously.
That could have as its drawbacks too.
Well,
but
it had its backlash.
Yeah.
There was truly a backlash after that, is that people got into like the Roaring Twenties and, you know, the libertine era. But and then of course there were people like Oscar Wilde who said, "The hell with this! I'm going to be like a total night owl and libertine lifestyle," and celebrated that in his in his novels and poetry.
European natural medicine states our most restorative sleep occurs between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is that's the most amped up melatonin. That's like the deepest waves of sleep. I think they're the Delta 4 waves where you're not dreaming yet.
Mm-hmm.
The REM sleep cycle gets longer as the night goes on. That's why we have a tendency to remember our dreams closer to the morning.
Yes.
You know, the dreams you've had after maybe
3:30,
4:30 a.m. or
mm-hmm.
something. So it's fascinating.
It's a lighter sleep closer to wakefulness. Yeah.
Speaking of Victorian era, but we just finished watching on Netflix, Downton Abbey, not Netflix, Amazon Prime, Downton Abbey the last season, and it was just so... It's like a great book. You don't want it to be over.
Right. And there's a lot of medical riffs in there. I remember when, what's her name? I forget the name of the character, but she's such a darling character, and she dies in childbirth.
Sybil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Spoiler alert. But anyway, so, but I was yelling at the TV. I was saying, give her some magnesium, because they give IV magnesium sulfate for that nowadays. Yeah. And they saved lives with IV. They didn't know that in whatever 1911 or I think it was probably around 1920 or something, because the series starts when the Titanic sinks in 1911, and it traces it through the teens and the 20s, of course, the World War, and then after the war, the aftermath of the war.
Yeah.
It's
so well done.
It's so well done.
Series. So well written.
Yeah. Yeah, and you develop an affinity for them. They become part of your family, you know.
Yeah.
Right, so I had to. But I think there's going to be some new series like that.
Hopefully.
Speaking, you know, this is a great digression, but I'm watching, I have a fascination with medieval England and the Vikings, which is medieval Scandinavia, which is one and the same.
That's on our list to watch, Viking series.
Okay, their Viking series is very good on Nat Geo. But also, I've been reading a series of books by Bernard Cornwell, called it's the Saxon Tales, and it's 10 books about a character who is a Saxon who's raised by the Danes. Anyway, he hangs out with King Alfred, who is Alfred the Great, the founder of England, the guy who actually unified all the various tribes of England in the 800s, like 890 or something. And what's interesting is they portray Alfred. There's a BBC series which I discovered, which is the book in a TV series. Alfred the Great, it turns out, had inflammatory bowel disease. And you can see this because he was, you can see he's like always in agony. He's holding onto his stomach. They describe this in the historical documents, is that he had, a lot of gastro problems. Mm-hmm. And so, and I said, I saw it and I said, this guy's got ulcerative colitis. They didn't know what ulcerative colitis was in those days. But then I read an article that was in an English medical journal. And this is a genre of medical writing, as they try to look at historical figures. Like, what was wrong with Napoleon? Did he have heartburn? Or, was he poisoned with arsenic? Or, did Abraham Lincoln have acromegaly? And all these kinds of things, they didn't know, but, whatever.
JFK probably had celiac disease.
Julius Caesar had epilepsy, blah, 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 blah.
Wow.
So all this. So they actually looked at all the historical documents. They conclude that he might have had Crohn's disease. Now, what's interesting in the book and in the series is that he's constantly eating this gruel, like porridge, which
Grains.
His wife, who's very pious, encourages him to eat because it's not Christian to eat meat. You must sacrifice. You must suffer, as Christ suffered. And there was a lot of that going on in the Middle Ages. There was like sacrifice.
And bread is the staff of life.
So he was consuming exactly the wrong food.
Exactly.
And, my goodness. And in fact, in he looks enviously at the plate of Uhtred, the Danish warrior, and he says, "I wish I could eat meat, but I can't."
Wow.
Because it would be an act of gratification, which he was always struggling with, that he was, the pious king, but he was subject to these earthly desire. Well, he would have done better if he eaten...
Totally, if he ate some meat some and some vegetables protein, or something. Wow.
All right. Well, we've digressed enough, I think. Let's answer some questions.
Actually, Dr. Hoffman, I've got a great comment here.
I think we've been watching, we've both been watching Amazon and Netflix too
over
the holidays.
It's okay.
Binge watching.
Okay.
That's what the holidays are for.
That's right. We've got, actually, we had back in 2013 an email from Waldo who talks about vitamin C.
A real person named Waldo.
A real person named Waldo.
Where is Waldo?
Exactly. I and my wife have been taking vitamin C since 1955. On the advice of a very smart family doc, we are now 93 and 91. This was in 2013. Waldo writes us again. A couple of months ago, November 2016, we are now 94 and 96, taking vitamin C since 1955.
Love it.
Dr. Julian Wilson, a guy way ahead of his time.
Was it Julian Wilson or Juan Wilson?
Juan Wilson. Juan Wilson.
There's a holistic doctor named Juan Wilson.
Okay. Yeah. So, since the 50s, and they are now in their mid-90s. Wonderful, Waldo. That's great.
So, Waldo, promise us that in 2020, that you'll send us another email. By the way, it's sent via email.
Yes, sent via email.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love email literate, nonagenarians.
Right.
I think that's great. And I hope that he has the wherewithal to access our podcasts on his computer or iPad, because those are a treasure trove. And if you listen to them, they'll engage your mind and keep you young.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for your email, Waldo. Keep on keeping on.
Right on, right on.
We have an email from Jan. Will you please comment on the health benefits of the prebiotic glucomannan? The benefits are supposed to be for weight loss, lowering cholesterol, controlling blood sugar. Is it a miracle cure or is this just hype?
Well, you know, I would say that anything that you consume that has a high bulk will displace appetite to some extent.
It will.
And, you know, like if you swallow a ball of yarn, you know, you're going to, every day, you're going to lose weight or die, one way or the other. But, you know, glucomannan is actually sometimes recommend, or it's called konjac as well.
Konjac.
It expands in the stomach like a sponge.
It does.
And so it can be a strategy for some people to help them eat less.
Right. You could take glucomannan, for example, a half hour, maybe 20 minutes before your meal, all three of your meals, with a big glass of water to fill you up.
Yeah.
The stretch receptors of the stomach. So that could be something. It's a water-soluble polysaccharide. It is a dietary fiber. It's also used as a food additive, as an emulsifier, a thickener.
Right.
As well.
Now, is there any downside or harmful effect of it, would you say?
Well, with any kind of fiber, I always recommend, you know, there are people who will take a whole lot of fiber but not enough water.
Right.
And that can cause the opposite effect. It could cause...
Get stuck.
It could get stuck. It could cause obstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly GI.
I believe the word for a kind distress. Of a fiber obstruction is a bezoar. A bezoar, which is actually, cats get bezoars when they lick themselves and they swallow a lot of hair and they get fur balls, and that fur balls kind of stay inside. And, can develop a fiber bezoar if you overconsume fiber without enough volume, or if you have part of the problem is these people don't have good transit. So some people try to overcome constipation by taking a lot of fiber.
Yeah.
And it just gets stuck. Because they don't have the transit to move it.
Mm-hmm.
So fiber is not always the, for many of our patients, not the answer for constipation.
Exactly. Either they're not taking enough water or it's not the fiber they need. It's about the transit. And sometimes a prebiotic coupled with a probiotic will do the trick.
Now, when you say prebiotic, is it possible that the glucomannan is one of the useful prebiotics that helps to encourage the growth of beneficial bacteria?
It can. It helps to, just like something like Flowey kiwi extract.
Kiwi extract, which is a fiber from kiwi plant.
And we have prebiotic foods as well. You know, things like Jerusalem artichoke. Leeks, asparagus.
How about acacia?
Acacia?
Yeah.
Acacia is more like a regular fiber than a prebiotic, but it could be.
Right.
It could be.
When we put people on a resistant starch diets?
Resistant starch is a little bit different. That supports the growth of butyrate.
Okay.
In the large bowel.
So in a sense, a prebiotic, because the bacteria have to act on these substances to break them down, manufacturing healthful short-chain fatty acids.
Exactly. Yeah. They have to ferment to agree. Now, the population of people where these types of things would be contraindicated would be somebody with SIBO.
Okay.
You don't want more fermentation, you want less, because it's like all this good prebiotic stuff is joining the party to feed the bad bacteria almost.
So until
we eliminate
right.
the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, it can be a problem.
So there's a wide-ranging discussion, but actually prebiotics may be contraindicated on the FODMAPs diet.
Exactly.
So because a lot of people have a lot of bloating, they're bloated.
Right.
Well, they shouldn't consume things like glucomannan or some of the FODMAP foods.
Right. Right. Your onions, your garlic, your broccoli, mm-hmm. cabbage, all of those kind of things. So that could be problematic, at least until the SIBO is taken care of. Anyway.
It's different strokes for different folks.
It is. Going back to glucomannan, clinical trials examining the use for weight loss have produced mixed results, pretty much.
You know, that's pretty diabetes. Much, that, you could say that about just about everything.
Yeah.
Almost everything in natural medicine is that mixed results.
Yeah. In type 2 diabetes, it may be a benefit. It's been shown to improve lipid profile.
Slowing transit on the theory that it slows absorption
of glucose
so that the glucose doesn't go all in a rush. However, another solution would be to eat less glucose.
Yes.
And less carbs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, don't take a glucomannan fiber and then go eat cake.
Right. Yeah. To counteract the cake.
Exactly.
You know, it's eat your cake and have it.
Eat your cake and have it.
With glucomannan.
So, Jan, you could take glucomannan if you wish. You could try it out. Keep in mind there are other prebiotic foods in the diet that you can, and also something
there's
like
another one that there's another one that actually Michael Murray likes, and I've talked to him a lot. He's a very smart guy, and we recently had a podcast on diabetes, and he likes a fiber called PGX.
Yes, Welbedex.
Welbedex, PGX. Which comes in various forms. You can put it in a liquid or you can take it in a pill.
Mm-hmm.
And it is said to slow the absorption of the food, basically, reduce the impact of the glycemic impact of a meal.
Yes.
And also to create some satiety, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which it does because it expands.
And that might be, if glucomannan doesn't work for you, PGX might be worth a try.
That's
true.
Mm-hmm. You could take a look at that at drhoffman.com.
We have that.
We
carry PGX. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you sometimes prescribe it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Jan, thank you for your question. All right. We've got an email from Vivian. Can you give an alternative to statins for heart disease and stroke patients? Well, that's a podcast. Wow. Alternative.
Well,
to someone who's, for people who've already had heart attack.
Okay, so here's the deal. Once you've had a heart attack or stroke, you're virtually certain to be prescribed a statin.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is there is, I think, fairly convincing data that use of a statin after a stroke, or in particular after a heart attack, reduces the risk of a subsequent event. It's a little less clear with stroke.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're starting to come up with studies that show a benefit in stroke patients. So pretty much you're going to be offered a statin. Why would you not want to take a statin? Well, some people just don't want to take a statin because it's a drug.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to take any drugs. I think that's an irrational approach because it's a little bit like saying, I don't know, just pick something arbitrary, you know, that you don't want to do because of an ideology.
Right.
And I think drugs have a place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's precisely where statins are most beneficial. I don't necessarily agree that everybody has got a little high, you know, cholesterol or is like, for example, I took a questionnaire and I'm in excellent shape. I took a questionnaire and said, you need immediately to go on a statin. Call your doctor. You know, it's like, no, you got it wrong. You know, because you think just because I'm a 64-year-old male, my cholesterol is a little high, 210, but my HDL is 70, and my blood pressure is normal, my weight is perfectly in the normal range, and I'm very athletic, that you say I need to be on a statin? It's like, why don't you look at my coronary arteries and see what's going on there? Then we did a podcast recently on coronary artery screening from the place we use in New York is Inner Imaging. It's the EBT scan. And there's a test which really will reveal whether you need to be on a stent. But look, once you've had a heart attack or stroke already, you've established that you're at high risk. You don't need to do an EBT scan. Mm-hmm. By definition, you're at high risk. So a substitute for some people is you can go on red yeast rice, which is a weak statin. That's how statins were discovered.
Yeah.
But, you know, the question is, why would you want to go on a nutraceutical that's not standardized, that, you know, some of the brands have toxins in them. The brand we carry, it does not. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you'll have to be a little cautious about that. At least drugs are somewhat standardized.
Right.
So the other thing I would say is that it's a very narrow thing to say, well, we'll just go on a statin. You must go on a very comprehensive program.
That's true.
If you have had a heart attack or stroke. It's about diet. It's about exercise. It's about stress reduction. It's about various other supplements that don't even have anything to do with cholesterol reduction, but protect the arterial wall.
Yes.
You know, such as chiolic aged garlic extract. That's a wonderful one. Vitamin D and vitamin K and omega-3 fatty. I must go on omega-3 fatty acids.
Yes.
You know, this thing was, they did an article, I remember in the New York Times back in 2004, saying in Italy, it's malpractice to not put a patient on fish oil after a heart attack.
Yes.
Here it's like, go ahead if you want, you know, it's
getting back to your test that you took that determined that you should take a statin as healthy as you are, I noticed, and I got quite angry when I saw this. I have a 16-year-old client, and her doctor did a lipid profile. I didn't ask for one.
Right.
Got a lipid profile, and apparently the new range for normal cholesterol, total cholesterol, is between 160 and 169.
Right. Well, let me comment on that. They're getting a little bit away from just using cholesterol as the criterion. Which is good in a way because they're, you know, as we know, 2/3 of people who have heart attacks have normal cholesterol.
Yeah.
And so cholesterol alone is not the determinant. So what they're attempting to do is, and with this little algorithm that I took, which is, it's a self-test you can take on the internet. They ask your age, your blood pressure, your height, your weight, your just some various basic stats. But the problem with that, is I think it's a recruitment for more people to go on statins.
Yes.
Because now it doesn't even matter what your cholesterol is. If you're like a 64-year-old male, you're at high risk by definition.
Yes. You know? Yes. Well, according to the blood test of the 16-year-old, she was told she had high cholesterol because her LDL was 104.
Oh, please.
Where they wanted it to be under 70.
No, but
for a 16-year-old.
And this is highly controversial as whether we should put children with, let's forget that. That's totally out of the ballpark. But let's say a kid has a cholesterol of 260 or something.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Put that kid on cholesterol-lowering medication for the rest of their life?
No.
That's a very unproven hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear what that would do to the kid's development. So,
right. They might be demented by the time they're 40.
Yeah. I heard that one of the companies, I don't know if it's in the States and it's in Europe, makes chewable statins so that small kids can chew the statins. I think there are some people very rarely who have a double hit on a gene which produces super high cholesterol. They could have cholesterol 500, 600, 700. That could be a case for, you know, a child going on a medication potentially, maybe.
Changes in diet first, please.
It's called familial hyperlipidemia, you know. But for those people, they just manufacture cholesterol. Diet alone isn't going to do it, you know. And they could get premature heart disease at a healthy weight on an excellent diet and a good exercise program because it's a terrible mutation.
They might need the additional fiber too to carry it out.
That is so rare. That's probably one in maybe 10,000 or so, you know, that you see that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So.
So anyway, the roundabout way of answering the question is, should you go on a statin or is there a substitute for a statin? You know, sometimes the best medicine is medicine.
Right. Right. Especially if you've already had a heart attack or a stroke. That's where.
And I know to depart with some holistic colleagues who maybe they're more pure as the driven snow and they don't ever recommend a drug, but that's not my, my orientation is that, you know, I'm trained in conventional medicine and I recognize that much of it is to be avoided.
Right.
But there's some tools out there that some people
there
might
are times
utilize.
Medicine is appropriate. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Vivian, thank you for your question. All right.
All right. So let's pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And so what can we be tackling in part two?
Comments about fish oil with regard to surgery seem to contradict the latest research regarding fish oil.
Okay, we'll find out what that's all about when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoppen today with Hoppen Center Nutritionist Layla Mudin, and we wish you again a happy new year. We'll be right back with more of our weekly Q&A with Layla.